If you're a person who's been raised in the Catholic Church, and you've heard all the sermons that we priests have been throwing at you for years, it might sound strange to you that the most important thing that you must do is love yourself. You must love yourself. That your whole capacity to love, to go out and to find God in a loving relationship will depend on whether you love yourself or not. Almost all Christian psychologists are convinced we don't want to really edit the words of Jesus, who said, love your neighbor as yourself. But all Christian psychologists that I know are convinced that it could be worded effectively this way: love yourself and you will love your neighbor. Hate yourself and you'll hate him too. It's almost as though a human being is like a bowl, and whatever fills you is going to spill out on other people. So if you're happy within yourself, if there's a sense of self-esteem, a sense of self-appreciation, you'll be a loving person because you'll be free to go out and love other people. If you don't love yourself, you won't go out. You'll use other people, and you'll always be looking around for someone that can fill your emptiness. And the emptiness ought to be filled with a real sense of self-celebration, a real sense of self-esteem and self-appreciation. Now, I don't know if you're struggling with this, but very often people say, well, isn't that being conceited? Isn't that being proud to love yourself? And the answer is, oh, no. No, no, no. When Jesus says, love your neighbor as you love yourself, he's strongly implying you got to love yourself. I don't know how this self-rejection bit got into Christian doctrine where we're supposed to say, I'm bad, I'm awful. You're not. Are you glad to be you? If you really are, if you're really comfortable within yourself, if there's no civil war going on inside of you of self-hatred, of push-pull, you will love other people. You'll be a very loving person because you don't have that pain to distract you and to magnetize your attention. Now, I have to say this because I believe it's true that every one of us has a pain inside of us that keeps us from loving. And the way you get it is by losing confidence in your own worth. How does a person lose confidence in his own worth? Well, it happens when people love you only conditionally. There are two kinds of love, and the only kind that helps is unconditional love. Conditional love says, I will love you if you keep your clothes clean, if you get good marks in school, if you look pretty, I will love you. I will love you if you don't give me any trouble. Now, this is conditional love. And most parents, what they say to their children without making a big speech about it is, if you go along with me, if you observe all the rules, you'll be all right. If you don't, you're dead. And they use kind of emotional come-ons and put-offs. If you're going along with me, if you get home on time, if you do everything I ask you to do, then you get my smiles and you get my hugs. But if you don't, I give you the cold shoulder. Now, that's conditional love. The other kind of love says, hey, I love you, and I am committed to whatever is best for you. So I'm going to be watching you, and I'm going to try to be whatever you need me to be. If you're lonely, I'll just sit beside you quietly. If you need someone to listen to you, I'll listen. If you need someone to talk to you, I'll talk. Need someone to be tough with you and challenge you, I'll do it. Need someone to be soft and sympathetic, that's what you need, I'll be it. Because I am for you. No matter what, I am for you. I'm your man. I'm your father. I'm your husband. And no matter what you do for me, no matter how you react, I'm going to love you. That's unconditional love. And that's the only kind of love that helps a person to believe in his own worth. Unconditional love. One of the psychiatrists who writes on this subject says that if a person feels he is loved only conditionally, he has to pay a price to get your love, in the end, he doesn't feel loved at all, he feels used. He feels like an object. He is hurt by this, and he loses sense of his own worth. His worth isn't in himself, his worth is in his performance. You know, one time, it was interesting, this is about 15 years ago, someone said to me, I would love you even if you were evil. And I remember being embarrassed. I didn't know how to respond to that. What do you say? Thank you? But I also remember that it tasted so good. I would love you even if you were evil. It felt so good as I thought about that. It was like an all-day sucker that I just savored. And here I am 15 years later quoting it to you and remembering who the person was, where we were standing, and all the circumstances. And I say to myself, why did that impress you so much? And the answer is, it's the only expression of unconditional love I have ever received in my whole life. That person was standing there and saying, you don't have to be anything. I just love you. You could even be evil, and I would love you. And that's what a person needs if he is to come into the fullness of life. Unconditional love. When you start pulling those levers, those come-ons and put-offs, I'll love you if, I'll love you but, I'll love you until, I'll love you when, you make the other person feel used. You aren't really loving me. You're loving my success or you're loving my looks. You're not loving me, and you're nobody till somebody loves you unconditionally. You're nobody. You're in pain and you can't go out to love anybody else until you have loved yourself. I'm afraid that most of us have an inferiority complex, that we struggle with this whole idea of, are we lovable? Are we good? Are we worth anything? Because that's the way most of us have been treated, isn't it? Do you think I'm being too harsh? Haven't the people who have loved you, as the people who have loved me, sort of set their own conditions? They brought their pan scales and they said, I'll put my donation here if you put yours here. Get your fingers off the scale. Because if you withdraw your gift, I'll withdraw mine. And that's not love. That's only conditional love. That's a business deal. That doesn't help anybody. And in the end, a person that you treat like that feels used, feels like a thing, feels like I have no good except my performance. You know, I have a personal problem, and I often wonder when I get a personal problem, doesn't everybody have it? I have a real need to please people, a real need to do things that are successful. I dread the thought of failure. Now, this is an indication to me that I have not yet really loved myself enough, because I'm still trying to perform for people. I'm still trying to pay the price of admission. I'm still trying to please them, because I'm not sure that I have any deeper worth than that. So I would ask you to think about this, about the quality of love in your life that you extend to other people, the love that you extend to other people, and also whether you have a sense of your own worth. Because everything follows from that. You just have to really think about this. A selfish person and one who loves himself are two different, totally different people. They say that the steps of maturity are, there are only three, to accept yourself, to love yourself, to be yourself, and to forget yourself. And that they must follow in this sequence. The first thing you have to do, the beginning of all growth, of all life, is to love yourself, is to have a sense of self-celebration going on inside you. And then you can be yourself, because you've made an act of confidence in yourself. Then you can act. You don't have to put on a mask or play a role. You can just be yourself. And when you are, people know that. Accept yourself, love yourself, then you can be yourself. And once you can be yourself, then you can forget yourself and really love someone else. Some years ago, a psychologist named Carl Rogers revolutionized the whole art of counseling. He said, everybody who comes in to be counseled has the same problem. He just has different symptoms. One man might come in and say, I'm drinking too much. One man might come in and say, I'm sexually promiscuous. One man might come in and say, I have a terrible temper. But these are symptomatic. These are not the real problem, Rogers says. The real problem is always the same in every troubled counselee. He does not understand and accept and love himself. And this may squirt out in one symptom or another, but the problem is radically the same. He does not understand, accept, and love himself as he is. And so Carl Rogers suggests that instead of giving advice, instead of jumping all over the symptom, you've been drinking too much, well, I'll give you the pledge now. Kneel down, raise your right hand. You just accept the man where he is. What the counselor is saying to the counselee is, I accept you. I understand you. If you can understand this person, for the first time, Rogers says, he will understand and accept and love himself. If you can do it. Because nobody can understand and accept and love himself unless somebody else does it for him first, from the outside. Your wives, your children, your friends, you hold their destiny in your hands, because if you can't love them, they can't love themselves. But if you do love them, they will love themselves. Because you're like a mirror. You're standing in front of me. You're saying, you're okay. Oh, you've got problems, and I'm not winking at them. I'm not saying it's a great thing that you get drunk or that you hate your wife. No, that's a problem. But I like you. I understand you. Now try this for size. Rogers says the minute the man really understands, accepts, and loves himself, the symptomatic problem will disappear. So when he stops getting drunk, when he stops beating his wife, when he stops being sexually promiscuous, you know it's happened. You have conveyed your understanding to him in such a way that he can understand himself now for the first time. You know, it happens very often that if someone has a habit of masturbation or some problem like this, and he comes into a priest and instead of giving him a big sermon and being angry and putting on all that false front, you just say, mm-hmm, yeah, I know. I understand. And I like you. For the first time, he doesn't feel that he's so bad, you know? He feels, are you really accepting me? Are you really saying I'm all right? And you say, yes, I'm saying you're all right. Then he begins to live. And then the symptomatic results of his basic problem disappear. On the other hand, Rogers says, what counselors have been doing is giving advice. And I think priests, have they not been notorious at giving bad advice? A man comes in and says, I'm drinking. He says, you don't mean alcohol, do you? Yes, Father, I meant alcohol. Well, you're not over-imbibing, are you? Yes, Father, I am. Sure, and you're not getting drunk? Yeah, I am. I am, Father. I'm getting drunk. And do you know what you're doing to your wife and your children? Oh, I do, Father. Oh, now get down on your knees and promise Almighty God that you will never drink again. You know what the priest is really saying to that man? If Roger's theory is right, that the man comes in and has this problem because he hates himself, you know what the priest is saying? I hate you too. You're really hateable, fella. I mean, you're on the right track when you hate yourself. And what is he going to do when he leaves the rectory? He's going to get drunk. He's got to get drunk. He's got to anesthetize this pain inside of him. He went in and told the priest he was hateable, and the priest agreed with him. The priest gave him a carbon copy of his own self-hatred. Sure, you're bad. Roger says to give a person advice, let me tell you what you ought to do, is implicitly saying, I don't accept you the way you are. Now, I hope I've been clear about that. When a person comes in and he's got a problem, he is getting drunk, you don't say, oh, that's great. It's not great. It's bad. But I understand you. I understand how... Yeah. I like you. Love the sinner and hate the sin. But you love the man. No, I understand. And the minute that is conveyed, the symptomatic problem disappears. All right? Now, what I try to convince people of, and I'm sure this is correct, that this kind of love we've been talking about is not a feeling. Love is a decision and a commitment. So when I say, I'm your friend, I'm always going to be your friend. You might even walk away from me, but I'm always going to be your friend because I'm offering you my love unconditionally in a commitment. And some days I may not feel very happy about you. I may feel nothing for you. You may feel homicidal and still love a person. And I'm going to love you. I'm going to do whatever I think is the best thing for you, for your security, for your happiness, for your well-being, no matter what. Love is not a feeling. Love is a commitment. If you saw the movie Butterflies Are Free, Goldie Hawn is a little nymphet who's running around from man to man, and she comes into an affair with Edward Albert, who plays the part of a blind boy, and she's getting ready to leave him. Butterflies are free. They can flit around from one pretty flower to another. And they pay a terrible price in the end. Because when she's getting ready to leave, he says to her, why are you leaving? He says, I don't know. I'm just getting tired. And he says, doesn't anyone ever get tired of you? She says, I don't know. I don't hang around long enough to find out. And she said, besides, you're crippled. And he says, oh, no, I'm not crippled. I'm only sightless. You're crippled. You're crippled because you can't belong to anyone. You can't put your life on the line. You can't make a wager of your life. You can't invest your life in anyone's happiness. You have no person called home. Oh, I'm only sightless. I'm only blind. You're crippled. Because you can't love. The love I'm talking about, when you put it on the line, when you make a decision, I'm committing myself to you. I'm offering you my friendship. I am your man. And you don't have to worry because I'm not bringing pan scales. I'm not going to see what you're going to return. And I'm not going to keep measuring. I'm your man. And there'll be times when you'll have to put up with me that I'm not feeling well, but I'm always going to be your man. And so insofar as I'm capable of it, I'm just going to do always what I think is best for you. This is unconditional love. It's the only kind of love that helps anyone. I would love you even if you were evil. That's how much I love you. This is what gives a person a sense of his own worth. Now, if you're understanding what I'm saying, if I'm saying it clearly enough, then you will conclude with me that it is a stupid question ever to ask a person, why do you love me? Because if you ask a person, why do you love me, the only answer that person can give is one of conditional love. I love you because you're pretty. You're beautiful. What about the days when I'm not pretty? What about when I grow old? Will you love me then? Is my beauty an admission price for your love? Well, I love you because you're good. But what if I weren't good? What if I were evil? What if I disappointed myself and disappointed you? Would you write me off? Would you wipe me out of your books? Would you give me the cold shoulder, the silent treatment? Get away from me, would you? If you love me only that way, you're using me. I feel used. Now, I think when I hear people come up to the altar as a priest to pronounce their wedding vows, being a university teacher, I perform a lot of weddings. I officiated a lot of weddings. And I hear them say, I take you in sickness and in health, for richer or for poorer, in a long life or a short life, and only one thing can ever separate us, and that's death. I will love you until death do us part. What they say in the wedding vows is an expression of unconditional love. I'm your man, I'm your woman, I'm your father, I'm your mother, and I'm going to love you. I'm going to do whatever you need me to do and be whatever you need me to be. If you need me to be tough, I'll be tough. If you need me to be velvet and gentle, I'll be velvet and gentle. Because I love you. And I'm going to appreciate all that is good in you, and I'm going to try to understand whatever is limited in you. I'm going to try to fulfill all of your real needs. Because I love you. Okay? That's what you have to set out to do in a love relationship. Now, I ask myself, when two people, whether they be husband and wife, father and son, priests in the same religious community, no matter who they are, if they're going to love each other unconditionally, they have to have good communication. Now, I would like to tell you the secret of good communication is communication of your emotions to the other person. Now, if you're one of those fellows that tends to deal with ideas, don't trouble me with feelings. I'm not the touchy-feely type. I'd like to tell you something about yourself. Nobody really knows you. Because the only time you really communicate yourself, the only time you really share yourself, is when you share your feelings. You and I have never had an original idea. You and I have never made an original choice. I tell you, I'm an Irish Catholic Democrat. And you say, oh, come on. The woods are full of Irish Catholic Democrats. You didn't tell me anything about you. I am a Roman Catholic priest. Yeah, but how many thousands are there like you? I am a Jesuit. There are 25,000 Jesuits in the world. But if I tell you how I feel about being a priest, I feel really privileged and proud, and yet humbled. And there are those moments I sit on the edge of the bed, and I don't want to be a priest at all. I don't want to go out to another day of service, of being taken for granted. When I tell you how I feel about being a priest, that I'm terrified that if I ever express my true feelings to anybody, he might judge the whole priesthood by me. He might say, well, if that's what the Catholic Church is, I don't want it. And I yearn for that freedom to be able to say things just as an individual and not have to bear the heavy yoke of Christ's priesthood. That's how I feel. Now, when I tell you how I feel, then you get to know me. When I tell you the facts, I'm a Roman Catholic Jesuit priest, that makes no difference. If you really want to share yourself, it's got to be at gut level. How do you feel? This is all the difference between a good relationship and a sterile one. And I want to tell you why I feel so strongly about it. Because I love my mother and father, who were married for 40 years and never knew each other. My father is dead. My mother is in a nursing home right now. Because they never told each other how they felt. Though they had arguments about issues and everything else, but they never said how they felt. And they had one of those sterile marriages, those truce marriages. Until one night when I was in eighth grade, and our family was always poor. The big thing was always how we were going to get enough money to do this, to buy this. Money was always the big problem. My father, the poor man, he sold shoes. And his brother was a lawyer. His sister was a university teacher and a poetess. My mother's brother was a president of a labor union. And my father felt like a black and blue failure. But he never said that. He never said anything about his feelings. You know what his motto was? Keep your bowels open and your mouth shut. And when I was in eighth grade, my mother came home and she said, wait till you hear this, everybody. I've got a job. I've got a job with the Board of Education. They're taking me back as a teacher. And they're starting me out at over $100 a week. And everybody let out a great hue and cry except my father, who said, don't take it. And I remember this. She turned on him and she said, don't take it? What do you mean, don't take it? On what you make, we can't even have the roof repaired. On what you make, we can never send the kids to college. On what you make. And he said, don't take it. Just don't take it. He never could tell anybody he felt like a failure. And she just kept saying, why not? And he kept saying, don't take it. They said that all night. And we all went to bed. They never told each other how they felt. When my father died in 1960, I flew home from Rome and I went into the hospital room. Stayed with him for about 20 days. And one day he sat up and his eyes widened and he had an emotional expression on his face and I knew he was dying. He sat up, his eyes widened, his mouth flapped open in a real look of awe. And I knew he was seeing the angel of death or Jesus. Someone was coming for him. I was standing right by the side of the bed. He was looking over my right shoulder and I braced the back of his head. And then when his eyes fluttered, I put him down gently on the pillow. And I closed his eyes and I said to my mother, it's all over, Mother. Dad is dead now. And she leaned forward and you know what she said? She said, he was so proud of you. He loved you so much. And I remember standing there like something had hit me in the chest. And fell down at my feet. And I just stared at her for a minute, and I wanted to say, but I didn't. Why did you say that? Why didn't you say one of the cliches that's expected of people at the moment of death, like, well, it's God's will, or it's a great blessing, or thank God it's over, or something like that. Why did you tell me he loved you so much? He was so proud of you. And I stammered, and I said, Mother, I think I should get a doctor now and a nurse to verify that Dad is dead. And I went out and got a doctor and a nurse, and they came in, and I was leaning against the hospital room wall, crying. And the nun nurse that had been attending my father came in, and she put her arm around me, and first she went to my mother, and then she came to me to console us. And she said, she used the cliches, she said, it's for the best. And I was standing there, and I was crying, and I couldn't talk because of my tears. But I wanted to say to her, Sister, I'm not crying because he's dead. I agree with you. It's for the best. I'm crying because my father never told me he loved me. I'm crying because my father never told me he was proud of me. I'm crying because I never knew my father. And now he's dead, and I will never know him. Because he wouldn't tell us his feelings. And I think I know what you're thinking, aren't you? You're thinking, but you knew he was proud of you, didn't you? You knew he loved you? And I say, oh, yes, yes. Sure, I knew. But you know what I don't want you to tell me? I don't want you to tell me that it wouldn't have made a difference if my father had told me that he loved me. Please don't ever tell me that it wouldn't have made a difference if he had told me how proud he was of me. If I had that memory right now of my father looking at me, or my father with his arms around me, or my father telling me, I love you, I'm really proud of you, it would make a great difference to me. On the way home from the hospital, I was driving my mother home after my dad died, and we called the undertaker, and he made the arrangements. And we're driving along Western Avenue. And my mother said, you know, if your father had been a loving man, I think I would be insane with grief. But he wasn't. He wasn't a loving man. And I remember wanting to rip the steering wheel off of the shaft and scream, but it was too late. He was dead. I wanted to scream, he was a loving man. He was. He could never hit us. Do you remember that? He'd take off his belt, but that's as far as he could go. Because he was so soft inside, so gentle inside, but he never could tell us. Don't you know I wanted to scream to my mother? Don't you know we never knew him? We never knew who he was. And after the funeral, and I was going back to the seminary, I noticed that my father had kept a subscription to Reader's Digest. And as he would sit up in his little hermitage and read through these copies, he would annotate the margins. This is a lot of bull. Don't pay attention to this. This is a good point. I like this man. And so forth. And I asked my family, could I take those back to the seminary with me? Stacks of old Reader's Digest from many years. And they said, yeah, you can have them, but what do you want them for? They're all old. And I said, I know. I want them, though. You know why I wanted them, don't you? I read everything my father wrote in every margin because I wanted to know who my father was. I wanted to know what he really felt like. And even now, sometimes I take him on a walk in controlled imagination, they call it. And I say to him, Dad, tell me what it was like Tell me about that feeling of failure that haunted you. And he looks at me, even in my imagination, as he once looked at me in life, and he says, never mind. Keep your bowels open and your mouth shut. Committed love is a beautiful thing. It really is. To say to someone, I'm yours. I'm your man. I'm your husband. I'm your wife. I'm your father. I'm your son. And I'm for you. And you don't have to pay any admission price. You don't have to be pretty or intelligent. You don't have to be or do anything. You don't even have to look any special way because I love you. Don't ever ask me, why do you love me? Only ask me one question. Do you love me? And the answer will be, oh, yes. Oh, I do. I love you. And the only thing that can make this succeed, this tremendous challenge of unconditional love, is communication at the feeling level. When two people are willing to share themselves with each other. And the only way we ever share ourselves, that unique part of us that no one else ever has as we have it, is our feelings. I have never had an idea that was absolutely original or made a choice that was unique. But no one feels about life, about himself, about his father, about his priesthood, as I do. And when I tell you those feelings, I'm telling you who I really am. And that's the greatest gift I have to give you, myself.